Okay, last week we talked about the story of David and Saul.
Okay.
And we talked about how Saul had been anointed king initially, and then David becomes king and all the complications therein. My plan tonight had originally been to get to Solomon tonight. I think we'll get to Solomon, but as I thought about it and really kind of put the class together, I realized it's impossible, because to really get from David becoming king to Solomon, there's just so much in between. So I think to ask me more about David's life as king, and then we'll get to Solomon and we'll see how far we get with it. But there's just too much to talk about. And the more I thought about it, began to realize that after Moses, David is probably the second biggest figure in Tanakh. Just as far as what's written about him, how much we know about him, just the depth of the stories, I think it's pretty clear. You can maybe even argue that David surpasses Moses as a central figure, you know, when it comes to the prophets. But you know, he's probably still saying Moses is. But after Moses, David is probably number two. So,
How about Solomon? He built the temple.
Yeah, but just as far as the amount of knowledge and the amount of information we have about their lives, Solomon's nowhere near David. Nowhere near. I mean, we're introduced to David at a very young age, and we know so much about his life. You know, when you go through the book of Judges, it's very common for it to just say, and they ruled for another 40 years, and then they died. So David rules for about 40 years, and we just, the amount of information we have, we have all these rich stories. We know him, we know his family, we know his wives, we know his kids, we know their lives.
There's how many nothing wives he had?
We'll get to that. Plenty. More than he needed.
More.
Depends who you ask. It's complicated. It's complicated. Okay. So we left off last week with Saul's death. We skipped a little bit at the end, but you got the picture. You got the picture. So Saul dies. Now when Saul dies, it's not as simple as David then becoming king of Israel, because he's not. Saul's descendants are not ready to give that up. And Saul's son, one second, let me get all out here. So Saul's son, Ish-Boshet, takes over as king of Israel, and David is king of Judah. Okay? So it's kind of a funny thing, because after Solomon, we'll see a real split of Judah and Israel being two separate kingdoms. That hasn't really happened yet. It's just kind of this natural progression that Saul dies, David is already so prominent that he's ready to be a king. And in Judah, where he's from,
he was anointed.
But he was anointed.
So they had some reason to anoint him.
No, no, for sure. Yeah, he was anointed as king. I mean, they had every right.
Long ago, before Saul died.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So,
but nobody knew about it.
It wasn't right. It wasn't publicized. Yeah. So he had every right to be king, but Saul's descendants were not going to go down quietly.
They never do.
They never do, exactly. So it was not as simple as, well, Saul died, now David is king.
Was the kingship intended to be hereditary?
It's not so clear, again, because once Hashem anoints David as the king to follow Saul, then clearly it's not supposed to just be hereditary. But at the same time, there is a natural progression, because when David dies, it's clearly assumed that one of his sons will become king. So there is a sense that it is hereditary. But yeah, that's not a given. That's not a given. But
I think it has a lot to do how much wealth you have too.
Well, this wasn't wealth.
Because,
I mean, Saul from
it was big tribes most of the time.
Yeah, but Saul to David was not wealth. because David was anointed by Hashem. After that, it gets complicated, because then there's real power struggles. So we'll see, even within David's own life, there's multiple attempts of different sons to jockey for position to be the next in power. So there was an assumption with David that one of his sons will be next, but that's also probably because David had been such a prominent king and such a successful king that why would anyone else be involved here? So it seemed pretty clear to everybody. It's just a matter of which son. And with multiple wives and many sons and from different wives, it was very complicated. Okay. we start off with a very kind of funny story. We're introduced to a number of characters, and I'll try to keep as many... I'll try to repeat the names and explain who they are, because it's complicated who all these different figures are. And their names are, you know, not common names, so it takes a little time. So Ish-bosheth is the king, is Saul's son. I'll write some names down just a bit to refer back to it. Okay, so Ish-bosheth is Saul's son. Okay? And he becomes the king of Israel. Then we have David. And David's going to have a line of his own. Saul's line is not going to last very long. They each have prominent kind of captains or generals of their armies. Okay? Ish-bosheth's name is Abner. How would I do that? I guess they're kind of, yeah. So he is Abner, or Avner. And David has Joab. Or English, Joab, and Hebrew, it's Yoav. Yoav is David's nephew. It's David's sister's son. Okay? We haven't met David's sister. We just met his brothers, but he has a sister, and she has a son named Yoav. Yoav becomes one of the most important figures in David's life. I mean, he comes up over and over. Most of the major stories involving David, somehow Yoav is always involved. He's a very aggressive, ambitious sort, but never tries to supplant David. Always works under David. But he's kind of got a rebellious streak, and he's got an independent streak that kind of comes out in different ways.
Kind of like Sharon.
What?
Kind of like Sharon.
Yeah.
He's not that bad.
So, the story begins where Abner and Yoav are kind of separated by this lake or this pool of water. And there's kind of this... There's a peace between the two sides. There's a peace between the north and the south. And you basically have the two generals stationed at the front, at the borders, kind of protecting it, but, you know, there's nothing going on. And they decide they're getting bored. Right? You've got two army generals, kind of young guys. You know, they're getting bored just sitting there. And they think it'll be fun, and they send out some of the youngest of their troops to have, like, you know, duels. You know, in the middle between the two. They'll have a duel, right? Just like, you know, fencing or whatever. Just for sport. Well, these young stallions take it a little too far. And in their duel, start actually killing each other. And then a war breaks out, of sorts. A battle breaks out because of their impetuousness.
A war or just a skirmish?
Well, the skirmish escalates quickly. There are three different nephews, okay? There's Yoav, there's Avishai, and there's Asahel. So Yoav, Avishai, and Asahel. Okay, so the three of them are all David's nephews, and they're kind of the leaders of the army. But Yoav, you'll see, is definitely going to be the most prominent one. Well, this battle gets intense, and Asael starts chasing after Avner. And Avner is a very, very, you know, he's powerful, he's smart, you know, he didn't get this position by accident. And Asael, as the skirmish escalates, begins to chase after Avner. And Avner starts to warn him, says, let's just stay away. You don't want any piece of this. And he keeps going, he wants to prove himself, he wants to conquer him. And Avner keeps warning him, and Asael doesn't stop. And it ultimately leads to Avner killing Asael. This doesn't go, you know, in self-defense. I mean, he is completely, you know, the way the text describes it, he's completely justified. So, then Yoav hears about this and sees this. And, I mean, this little game just really blew out of proportion. Now, one of his brothers just got killed. So, Yoav now goes after Avner for revenge. And to Yoav's credit, Avner says, look, this is what happened. We better stop this now, or this will become a full-fledged civil war if we don't stop it. So Yoav is smart enough to stop it and kind of leaves it as is. And they can leave it at that. But Avner is a very powerful figure who really ends up being the reason why Ish-bosheth has any power at all. Avner is really the one who kind of gives him his power. So, Ish-bosheth is not so smart. And he accuses Avner of basically of sleeping with one of Saul's concubines. A concubine was kind of, you know, not quite a wife, but somebody who was like lived with and protected by the king. You know, basically like a harem of sorts. So, Avner is accused by Ish-bosheth of sleeping with one of Saul's concubines. The text doesn't say now if he did it or not, but Avner is insulted. He said, how could you accuse me of such a thing? He says, I'm out of here. I'm going to go join David's forces. I mean, that's for Ish-bosheth. That's his, you know, he just basically kicked out the person who protected him. So Avner wants to defect to David, and David makes his there's one condition. So Michal, who we talked about last week, was one of Saul's daughters who had been married to David, or at least was promised to David, had, you know, with all the hullabaloo of Saul trying to kill David and David being on the run, Michal was married off to somebody else. And David said, Avner, you want to come join our side, you have to bring Michal with you. It's time for her to come back. No, I was married to her, I was supposed to marry her, bring her back. So he does. So they kind of strike this arrangement where Michal is brought back to David. And things were going okay.
Yeah? What about her husband?
Her husband was not so happy with the arrangement.
Okay.
Her husband did not agree, but he was just...
They had a disagreement.
Yeah, but as we'll see later, you know, if David wants to marry someone, there isn't much you can do to stop him. So, although this time he was much more justified. I mean, he really had, you know, either married or been promised her. So, it was just, I mean, he had a leg to stand on here. But, be that as it may. So they bring her in. So Michal's brought back. Avner then is kind of becoming part of the team, and Yoav, seeing that Avner has now come to their side, kills Avner. Right? Saying, you know, you killed my brother. What's the line from that movie, Princess Bride? You killed my father, prepared to die. So you killed my brother, prepared to die. How could you bring Avner in here? You're, you know, he's a traitor.
How did he kill him? I mean, how did that happen?
So he tricked him. He tricked him into... he said, David wants to speak to you in private. Come. Avner walked in.
He ambushed him,
yeah.
That's not righteous-like. That's not...
No, David didn't do it. Yoav did it.
Oh, Yoav.
No, unbeknownst to David. Oh, yeah. David then is very upset at Yoav for doing this. No, David didn't want this at all. David mourns Avner. David's very upset with Yoav. And but he also it's complicated because he really needs Yoav. Yoav is clearly the most fit person to lead head up the army.
I think the whole family were there.
What?
His sister's family was strong.
Yeah, yeah. So So Avner, who was poised to then become part of the team and a very powerful person within David's army, is assassinated. So again, this is just one example of Yoav's involvement, where he gets involved in things that he really shouldn't be involved in. But it was personal, it was family, and he kills him. Saul's son Isboshet is then killed, he's assassinated, and that's pretty much the end of the line of Saul. So the two people that assassinate Saul try to then, they think if they assassinate, Isboshet, if they assassinate him, then they'll be in good favor with David, because now David will be able to kind of take over the entire country. So they show up at David's doorstep and say, hey, you know, we're the ones who killed Isboshet, you know, what gifts do you have for us? And he has him executed for treason. So it didn't work out so well for them. It does happen. So David is king of Judah, Judah and not the entire country, for 7 months, 7 years and 6 months. And he rules in Hebron, That's his base. And so that's the, that had been kind of the place where everything was based. And so he rules another 32 and a half years of the entire country. He rules for 40 years. So seven and a half of those first years were just the southern kingdom of Judah. So then David occupies and he conquers Jerusalem, and they move the capital to Jerusalem. Right, so they get the ark, they retrieve the ark, and they move it to Jerusalem, and that's when Jerusalem becomes the capital during David's time. To that point, it hadn't been. They now have to move the ark to Jerusalem, and there's a little story here of Uzzah, one of the people who is charged of helping with the ark. He thinks the ark is slipping from, you know, where it's being held, and it might fall. So he goes, puts his head to touch it, and he dies because he's now touched the ark. Anyone seen Raiders of the Lost Ark will know that. So he dies, and David's upset, but it's kind of his own fault. Then there's a little story here. David is accompanying the ark, and for him, this is a pretty big deal. He's conquered Jerusalem, which they know is going to be where the temple will be built. They're bringing the ark into it. This is basically the beginning of them building the temple, building the Beit HaMikdash. So he's very excited, and he's dancing, and he's kind of getting really into it. And, you know, so his wife Michal looks at him and thinks that he's kind of making a fool of himself. Right? He's going over the top. You're the king. You should be stately. You should be, you know, you should be more stoic. You know, you shouldn't be dancing like a fool. So she kind of rebukes him. He says, you know, this is what you're rebuking me for. I have every right to do this. This is such an occasion. I can't believe you're even, you know, thinking this way. And Michal, you know, from that point forward, is not so relevant. And the text says she doesn't have any more children from that point forward as like a punishment for what she did. So David now wants to start to build a temple and kind of appeals to Hashem with the prophet Natan Hanavi, and Nathan, Natan, he's a prophet during the time of David, and he has a close relationship with David, and he comes up a few different times as being like a confidant or someone who rebukes David. He seems to be the one person David really listens to and respects, and Hashem uses Natan to speak to David very often. So he kind of appeals to Hashem, and Hashem lets him know, you're not going to be the one to build a temple. You've got too much blood in your hands. It might be justified, but you're not the right one. Your son will build the temple, not you. So David can kind of help lay the groundwork, which he does, but that's why he's not the one to build the temple. He's frustrated by it, but he has to accept it. Okay. Yeah, that's not so important. So David then, there's a few stories here of David defeating his enemies. He defeats Ammon. Ammon tries to cause problems, and they fight them back. And again, Yoav is central in doing that. Same thing with the Philistines, who keep coming up over and over again. Basically, we get to a point where David's kind of got the system in pretty good shape. He's got his soldiers, he's got his armies, they moved into Jerusalem, they've built kind of they've set up there. Things they're in pretty good shape. And that's when the story of David and Bathsheba happens. So David sees Bathsheba one day, she's bathing on top of a roof, and he sees her and he wants to marry her. Only problem is, she is already married. That doesn't stop David. David brings her over, has his messengers come and take her to the kingdom. He sleeps with her that very day. She's brought to the house. She becomes pregnant, and she lets David know, "I'm pregnant." David then finds out, gets her husband, Uriah. Uriah comes back. Doesn't know exactly what's going on here, but he's being treated nicely. He's really confused by what's going on. Finally, David tells Yoav, I want you to send him to the front lines and basically make sure that he doesn't come back. And
that's not nice.
What?
That's not nice.
Not so nice. So that's what happens. So Uriah goes out to war, doesn't come back, and then David marries Bathsheba. A few points about this story. So the Talmud discusses this in a few different places. That technically you could make an argument why this wasn't adultery. Okay, the main argument that Talmud makes why it wasn't adultery per se is that all the soldiers when they went off to war would write a bill of divorce for their wife, retroactive to them leaving. The reason being,
but only if they
didn't come back
in the battle,
right?
But if they
if they didn't come back a certain amount of time,
they were probably be missing in action. Then the wife,
but right,
wasn't missing.
The main fear was that if a husband was missing in action and they didn't know if he was alive or dead. So his wife would be stuck for who knows how many years. She couldn't remarry because you can't get divorced to somebody unless you know that they're dead or they are there to have a divorce. But they can't, as long as there's a chance that they're alive, she can't actually get divorced. So to avoid this, every soldier would have to write a Jewish bill of divorce, retroactive, meaning it was on condition that they didn't come back by a certain... If I'm not back by, X amount of time, then you'll be retroactively divorced. So since that was the case, if he doesn't come back, then the divorce officially happened before he first went off to war. And then since Uriah was already a soldier when David slept with Bathsheba, so then retroactively they were divorced when they actually were together. At the same time, so the Talmud, it's interesting, the Talmud in some ways goes very far to at least give David some leg to stand on. Not to justify it, but to mitigate it. So it doesn't seem quite as bad as it seems. But the text doesn't really give David a whole lot of flack. I mean, it gives him flack, it doesn't give him a lot of slack. Yeah. It's very clear that it disapproves, and it's pretty, so the mourning passed. Uriah's wife heard that her husband Uriah had died, and she mourned over her husband. The mourning passed, and David sent for her and brought her into his house, and she became his wife and bore him a son. 5 months later, right? The deed that David had done was deemed evil in the eyes of Hashem. So it's pretty clear in the text that Hashem did not think this was so good. Nathan, Hashem then uses Nathan to rebuke him. And to they use this little parable. And the parable is you've got two men in the city, one's rich and one's poor. The rich man has all, whatever he wants, he has at his disposal. And he's got all these animals he can use, and he's all these, you know, he's got tons of cattle. And what happens? Somebody comes to the rich man and is hungry. So what does the rich man do? He goes to the poor man who only has one animal, takes that one to feed him instead of using one of his own. So basically to David, look, you've got already, you know, however many wives. You've got anyone that you want. How can you, this poor guy, you know, he's got his wife and that's all he has and that's all he's ever going to have. And how in the world could you do this? You know, it's a misuse of power. And that's an important theme here, because as the king was such a new concept, as like we talked about in Shoftim and then into the story of Saul and David, the people were warned that kings tend to abuse power. And when you give someone a lot of power, they're going to tend to abuse it from time to time. And David, who was as righteous a king as we've ever had, and whose heart was in the right place as much as any king we've ever had, still this happens, right? He abuses his power. However you look at it, he abuses his power. And, you know, David is definitely seen as, in some ways, the paradigm of just a very aggressive male, right? And, did we tell a story? That the Talmud tells a story. It might be one of the commentaries. That one of the reasons, you know, when Samuel was sent to anoint the king and sent to Jesse's home and saw all these boys, when he sees David, he's taken aback. Partly because he's the youngest and the least assuming that he would be the next king. But partly because he had this wild red hair, right? And his reaction is, this is Esav, right? He thought he was Esav. And Esav had this wild red hair and was aggressive and was violent. And Hashem says to Shmuel, it's true, he's like Esav. The only difference is he's going to use it for good. But there is still just a very aggressive nature to him. And, you know, it tends to be the case that aggressive men, you know, are aggressive and in many different ways. And they're aggressive here as well. So it's just kind of part of the nature of David that he had this wild, you know, he was just very aggressive. And from time to time, he had trouble fully controlling it. The Talmud also goes, kind of explains that David made a mistake. And the mistake he made was, David is well aware of how, you know, he was obviously aware of his aggressiveness. And he was aware that it could lead to bad things. And in some ways, he was kind of bothered by it. Right? And you hear this, you'll hear men talk this way sometimes, that it's kind of a curse, right? That sexuality is a curse for men very often, because if they're so driven and they're become obsessed with it, that it just kind of becomes too consuming, and it's something they just can't find a way to get out of their heads, and it's not productive. So David realized that about himself, that he just was too, you know, it was this ever-present desire going on within him that he couldn't get rid of. You know, how do you get rid of this? Of course, if he got rid of it, he wouldn't be David. But at the same time, it was holding him back. So his plan was this. His plan was he would sleep with one of his wives in the morning. Okay? This way, he'd kind of get out of his system, and the rest of the day, he'd be fine. That's the Talmud says. That was David's plan.
Okay. You told this to
me. I told this before.
Because then he saw someone taking a shower or something.
Well, yeah, so that's not right. So the problem was that the Talmud says David made a mistake that doesn't work that way. Right? It doesn't work that way. He thought, like, hey, you're hungry, so you eat, and then you're not hungry anymore. They don't think about food because you're not hungry. But he said, the Talmud says that sexuality doesn't work that way. It doesn't follow the regular rules. That the way the Talmud says, the more you feed it, the bigger it gets, right? It doesn't get smaller, it gets bigger. That the desire gets bigger when you keep feeding it, and it wants it more and more and more. It doesn't work like eating. So that's why David was even more susceptible, was because, you know, unwittingly he had basically, instead of lessening his desire, had amped it up another level. So now he was, you know, he was like a hyperactive teenager. And this is how it ends. So there's a few little interesting points from the Talmud, kind of about some of the back parts of this story. So he is rebuked, and David is kind of in denial as to what happened, and it's justified, and I'm the king, and I did it legally, and I'm allowed to send him to war, I didn't break the law. So he has a hard time really kind of fessing up. And finally David's able to say, you know, so it culminates here when David finally says to Nathan, Vayomer David al Natan chatati l'Hashem. Finally he says, okay, I sinned before God.
Did it say before I was justified? Text says I was justified.
I don't know if he says he's justified.
I think just nothing came and made a speech, and then David said, you know, you're right.
David was very indignant about this man, and he said to Nathan, as Hashem lives, any man who does this deserves to die, and he must pay fourfold for the... He had some justification.
That's to the parable.
To the parable, yeah.
Not to his own shortcomings.
Fine. Once he was confronted, you're right. I'm not saying... Maybe he wasn't... You're right.
Once he was confronted, he said, you're right.
Fine. But he didn't come to it on his own. It took Nathan, right, pushing him... You're right. Good point. So David confesses, but it's not that simple. And the son that's born from this illicit relationship gets sick. David prays for the child, but the baby dies. And the text makes, you know, seems to say that this is the punishment, right? That is his, you know, infant child dying, even with all of his prayers, that comes from this illicit relationship, that's the punishment. And David's distraught and kind of has to come to grips with it. They have another child, and his name is Solomon and Shlomo. So Shlomo is the child born after they're already married, after the story's over, and, you know, you can imagine after a baby dies like that. So the next child that's born obviously is extremely precious to both of them. But David's sons were not also simple. So he has a lot of sons from different mothers, and it made for a very complicated family dynamic. So here's just for a few. So he has Amnon, whose mother is Ahinoam of Jezreel. Well, let's focus on two right now. We're going to focus on Amnon, and we're going to focus on Avshalom. Okay. Avshalom, whose mother is Maka the Kenite, who was not Jewish and then converts. So Amnon is obsessed with his half-sister Tamar. Tamar's brother is Avshalom, and he becomes obsessed with her. And he decides to kind of trick her. So Amnon pretends to be sick, and he has someone call Tamar in and take care of him. He was sick. She, you know, she looks after him, and then they're alone together, and he rapes her. There's a bit of a discussion in the commentaries that it wasn't technically incest, since Tamar was born before her mother converted, therefore she halakhically became a Jew after she converted, so she wasn't technically, it was a whole thing. But anyway, so maybe technically in Jewish law they weren't officially brother and sister, but obviously another example of, you could, you know, if you're, you know, you can look for technicalities, but this is obviously a repulsive and disgusting thing to do. And Amnon has a funny reaction. After he rapes her, he doesn't want anything to do with her ever again. He just, like, kicks her out, and, you know. So this wasn't love. It was this kind of strange sexual obsession. And Avshalom, her brother, finds out and basically vows revenge. And Avshalom arranges, he kind of has somebody at his behest kill Amnon. So, you know, Avshalom feels like he's doing the right thing, he's going to kill him. David, obviously, there's problems in the family. You know, having eight wives is not as simple as it seems. And now there's a big problem in the family. David basically sends Avshalom into exile and is distraught that one of his sons has been killed. So he's gone for 3 years. Avshalom is kind of in exile. And Yoav, our friend Yoav, comes back and begins to realize that David wants to bring Avshalom back. But at the same time, Avshalom, that David feels like he can't show weakness, and you know what Avshalom did was, you know, justified to an extent, but he took the law into his own hands, you know, and his father's the king. He could have handled it, you know. He was a little bit too impetuous. So Yoav decides that, but he begins to think and realize that David really wants Avshalom to come back, so he kind of sets up this interesting little situation where he gets this woman to come before David and appeal to him in this whole story. Her husband had passed away, she has two sons, one son killed the other son, and now the family wants revenge. Can you protect my son? This is my last remaining child, and my husband passed away, it's his last remaining heir. Please don't let this happen. And David says, of course, I'll make sure to protect him, we'll take care of it. And then she says to him, well, actually, I'm talking about you. this was all a ruse to kind of get David to begin to think and to talk about what happened with his own kids. And David realizes that Yoav was probably behind it. He even asks, was Yoav behind this? And she says, yes, he was. And then Yoav begins to make this, you know, make the reunion possible. So first they bring Avshalom back into Jerusalem. And still, there's 2 years, but Avshalom kind of is brought back into the fold, but David and him don't see each other, they don't meet. David's not ready to see him. So finally, Avshalom sets something up, and kind of forces David's hand, and David and Avshalom have a reunion, and David kind of forgives him. However, David might not have been so smart in letting him back. Avshalom doesn't stop here. He now begins a plan to try to overthrow his father as king. And I mean, the story is David's life is incredible. So now Avshalom begins to slowly but surely try to curry favor. His father is getting older. It's at the end of his reign, so David is kind of near the end, not quite as powerful, not quite as youthful, and the writing is on the wall that that someone's going to be the heir. Who's it going to be? So it's not so clear to anyone who the heir is going to be. So Absalom tries to force David's hand, and he begins to become a man of the people. And he goes throughout the country, and he's trying to provide judgment for people. He's trying to help. He's helping the weak. He's a presence all around the country. He's trying to get grassroots support for what eventually will be, no one knows this, but will eventually be a hostile takeover. So he wants to get the people behind him. And it's not hard for him to do so. He's the king's son. And the text says he's charismatic, he's good looking, he's got this long hair which comes back, he's got this beautiful wife. Everyone is like, you know, impressed by him. He's David's son. He has no problem going through the country, and everywhere he goes, he gets this warm response, and he's beginning to kind of sow the seeds for rebellion. Finally, he declares his rebellion, that he's ready to attack, and that he's not going to attack right now, but he's declaring his intentions, and he grabs Achitophel, who is David's top advisor, and the text makes it pretty clear this was a big deal, that Achitophel was David's right-hand man, and was his, you know, in some ways the brains of the operation. Why would Achitophel switch? Why would Achitophel go from David to Avshalom? It seems like a strange thing for your trusted advisor to do. Why would you leave to this young rebellion for this kind of wild son who's got his own history? It seems like a funny thing to do. So I think it's the Radak who says that that Achitophel was Bathsheba's grandfather, and he had this kind of resentment to David for what happened to Bathsheba, for what he did to Bathsheba and to her husband. So he kind of had been waiting to a certain extent for an opportunity to kind of pay back. And that's his understanding. So now Avshalom really is starting to get legitimacy and power. Now he's got like a strategist, right? You know, every good politician needs a chief strategist. And that's what Achitophel is. He's a strategist. Avshalom is the front man, and he's strong, and he's powerful, and he's popular. But he needs, Achitophel is, two generations older than him. He's seen it all. He's been in the kingdom. He knows what's going on. And when David sees that Achitophel has kind of switched sides, now he really gets nervous. Now this is serious. And he goes into exile, and he goes into hiding. Most of the people are still very loyal to David. But still, he sees that this is going to get very contentious. And the last thing he wants is a full-fledged civil war with his own son. So what David does to fight back is he gets one of his other advisors, Hushai, to become a secret agent, to infiltrate the enemy.
CIA.
Right. To spy. He has another agent go and pretend to join the rebellion. But really, he's on David's side the entire time. Okay? So, I don't know how David's life is not a movie. I don't understand. I mean, this is better than any movie you can imagine. So Hushai then crosses over and earns their trust and is kind of welcomed into the fold. Achitophel then goes one step that's a little too far. Avshalom says to Achitophel, give counsel, what should we do? What should be our next move? And his next move, he tells him, is to go and to sleep with your father's concubines. Kind of like what Avner had been accused of. But that's when Saul had passed away. Saul had been dead already. Here, as like a sign of strength, that, this is my palace now. In front of everyone, make sure it's well known what you're doing. Basically, by sleeping with the concubines, it'll show that you are now in control. Your father can't even stop you from sleeping with the concubines. So they do that, and obviously this is not, not the way to kind of get the most respect necessarily, but it is a sign of strength that he's trying to portray, and he does. So Achitophel then decides, he proposes kind of the surprise attack on David. David's in hiding, David's kind of in a potentially weakened state, and Achitophel proposes a surprise attack, and that's when Hushai, the secret agent, is there and dissuades Avshalom from doing that, because Hushai knows this would work. Achitophel is good at what he does, and Hushai just tells him not to and to do it more head on, and which gives David time to prepare, and then Chush is able to send informants to David, letting him know what's happening, so they can prepare him and they can know when Avshalom is ready to attack. Achitophel realizes what's happening. He realizes that Hushai's that this is, you know, at this point, once Avshalom stops listening to Achitophel, Achitophel realizes that this is not going to end well. That's the plan is a terrible plan. It's going to lead to their destruction, and Achitophel is now at a point where he can't go back. If David defeats Avshalom, what's going to happen to Achitophel? It's complete treason. So he commits suicide because he realizes that this is the end, and he doesn't want to be turned over to David. He rather just ends it himself, and he does. So now Avshalom's camp is complete disarray. His top lieutenant just committed suicide. His little top lieutenant is really working for his father. So the end is near. There's a strategy. David ends up defeating Avshalom, doesn't kill Avshalom, and doesn't want to kill Avshalom. And David tells the army not to kill him. But Avshalom, it's kind of irony, is he's riding on his mule. The mule comes under a tree with thick branches, and his lovely, long, thick hair gets stuck in the branches. The mule keeps going, and he's literally stuck in the branches by his hair. Yoav, our good friend Yoav, who's always around, sees this, figures out what's happening, and says, let's just kill this guy now, and they kill him. He kills him. So Yoav comes back. And again, so Yoav is the one who brings Avshalom back, and then Yoav is the one who kills him. David's upset. Yoav doesn't really care. So
cares.
What?
He gives a whole speech why he had it done.
I'm saying Yoav doesn't really care that David's upset. I mean, Yoav thinks he's right. He said, look, he had to die. He deserved it. You're his father.
He gives a whole speech one.
Yeah, no, I'm saying.
If it was up to Avshalom, nobody would be alive.
No, I'm saying Yoav, and you could definitely make the argument.
How many sons David had?
I think it's eight or nine.
No daughters?
No, he had daughters too, sure. Well, Tamar was one of his daughters, and the one who was raped. I don't have a list. It's kind of spread out throughout the decks. I don't have a list in front of me.
It's probably a lot more than recorded.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, we don't really know. Between the concubines and the wives, and we only know some of the sons that are relevant, right? There's a bunch that we might even know about. Okay. Yeah, I mean, a few more stories kind of finish it off. None of them are, there's a few more rebellions, a few more situations that happen, but, we hit the kind of the biggest stories. At the end here, there's a story about the Gibeonites, the Givonim. The Givonim, a group of people that when Joshua conquers the land, they don't want to fight. And they kind of concede, and they say they'll convert, and they'll just become, peaceful with the Jewish people. So there's the episode earlier that Saul has a battle and kills some of the Givonim. So the people are punished because of that. So there's a famine, and then they want seven Jews killed as like in revenge, and they have to pick the seven people. So it's a little story about that, and there's a few other stories.
From
Shaul's sons.
Yeah.
Right. So they want Shaul's sons or descendants killed. So they kill a bunch of them, but they save Yonatan, Jonathan's son. So David's able to save him from this. So his son Mishibothe is able to save. Yeah, so then a few more stories of giants similar to Goliath and the Philistines, and they begin to attack again, and then David and the army, they kill them. And then that's you know, the majority of the story here. David's life ends in the beginning of Malachim, the beginning of the first book of Kings. So on his deathbed, we have another rebellion. His son Adoniyahu tries to make himself king. Adoniyahu's mother was, I always forget, of Haggit. So now he wants to be the king, even though it had already been promised to Solomon to Shlomo. And so he begins to get his own army, and Adoniyahu begins to get his support. And now David's literally at the end of his life, so he's not really rebelling against David, it's more against Solomon. So Natan and Navi, Nathan and Bathsheba get together, and you know, we have to have David in his lifetime really stop this, because once David dies, now you should have a big civil war. So Bathsheba pleads to David, Natan and Navi supports it, David kind of comes through with it. And Solomon is made the king. And that kind of ends the story of David. At the end of his life, David is able to kind of pass on to right, so he kind of passed it down to Solomon, some life lessons that he had learned as a king, and some of the residual stuff. So he, you know, he kind of tells him about Yoav and says, look, he was helpful, but he did a few things they shouldn't have done, especially what happened with Avner. So we'll pick up with this next time. So we'll get into the story of Solomon, and then I want to go from there to the stories of Elisha and Eliyahu and Elijah.
How did David pick Solomon?
The text says when Solomon's born that he was, you know, there was a certain feeling David had that Bathsheba should be the one who, you know, her son should be the one who took over, and Solomon clearly showed. Let me go back to that story.
I'm surprised all this fighting between the Israelites. Country came in and took over.
Well, there's a lot of they fought off a lot of rebellions for sure. I mean, I didn't get into all the stories, but there's a lot of that.
Well, they were strong too.
Israel was strong. Yeah. I mean, that at any point in history, that's when they're strong. So this is what it says when Solomon's born. David comforted his wife Bathsheba. This is after the first child died.
Yeah.
And he came to her, lay with her. She gave birth to a boy and called his name Solomon. Hashem loved him. So when it says Hashem loved him, and that's what it says about David multiple times, that Saul saw that Hashem was with David, that there's a certain sense that this child, you know, David had a sense that this child, as he's growing up, should be the next king. So there's prophecy, and there's a... One second, there's one more. Does make sense. Okay, yeah, that's it. That's yeah. So I mean, this is seen as an allusion to, you know, when it says that Hashem was with Solomon, it seems like it's an allusion to the fact that he should be the next king. But it's not explicit in the same sense.
Yeah. The text, I don't think ever mentioned the promise.
It never mentioned an explicit promise, but it's clear to the people. It's clear to Bathsheba. It's clear to Nathan. Right. It never says. Order. Yeah.
And Solomon comes a king. Is any of his brother help him?
No, he's really on his own.
Or they're like, I guess they're the princes or something like that.
Like, but so here in Divrei Hayamim, in Chronicles, this is near the end of David's life. David summoned his son Solomon and charged him to build a temple for Hashem, God of Israel. David said to Solomon, "My son, I had in mind to build a temple for the name of Hashem, my God, but the word of Hashem came to me, saying, 'You have shed much blood and have made great wars. You shall not build a temple for my name's sake, for you have shed much blood upon the ground before me. Behold, a son will be born to you. He will be a man of rest, and I shall grant him rest from all his enemies all around. His name will be Solomon, and I will bestow peace and tranquility upon Israel in his days. He will build a temple for my name's sake.'" So here, it's not in Samuel, but later in Chronicles, in Divrei Hayamim. So here, David, when he talks to Solomon about it, seems to say that Hashem had this prophecy that he'd be born the son, and this would be, and he would be the one who would build the temple. So it seems that David had that, yeah. So it is referenced here in chapter 22, Chronicles 1, chapter 22, verse 9. So,
if he didn't build the temple, he built Jerusalem, right?
Right.
Because there is a David Tower.
Right. So he's the one who conquers Jerusalem. He begins to build up Jerusalem. He lays the groundwork for Solomon to build the temple. So he does a lot of the dirty work to then allow Solomon, when he takes over, to just focus on building the temple of Beit HaMikdash. All right, we'll stop here.